This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Agent in Place. Written by Mark Graney. Performed by Jay Snyder.
Prologue. The prisoners were slaughtered one by one, with efficiency as true as a ticking clock. 24 dead now, and the executioner was just hitting his stride. The scene of the massacre was one of abject horror. The stench of fresh blood, the cloying smell of bodies floating in the brown lake, the viscous brain matter splattered and thickening on the sun-blanched pier. Above the slaughter, the rocky hillside sparkled in the midday heat, the reflection of broken glass and twisted metal jutting out of the wreckage of a battle fought months ago. Many had died, and the few vanquished who survived had run for their lives and left the ruined land to the victors. The black flags of ISIS hung in the town square now, and they waved from the rooftops of the wrecked buildings and whipped in the back of most every pickup truck that rolled through the broken streets. Certainly every vehicle that was filled to capacity with young bearded men wearing cheap tactical gear and brandishing weapons, eyes wild with the fervency of their sickening death cult. Here by the lake, between the broken hillside and the water, ran a narrow shoreline of salt flat and brown brush. 43 condemned men in orange jumpsuits knelt, the remainder of the 67 who had been trucked here just 20 minutes earlier. The captives were surrounded by masked fighters holding rifles at the ready. The prisoners' wrists were tied with rough cord in front of their bodies, and they were all lashed together by a long rope. This removed the chance that any one of them would get up and leg it, though it hardly mattered. Nobody was going to run. It was nearly 100 kilometers across the dead ground of worn-torn Syria to the Turkish border, so what chance would they have if they ran? No one entwined and kneeling here would resist the fate that awaited him. There was no use to it, and virtually all these men understood that their last few moments left on this foul earth would be better spent praying. The executioner wore a pair of daggers in his belt, but these were just for show. The real tool of choice for the slaughter wasn't the blades. It was the Avtomat Kalashnikova, model 74U, held in the arms of the hooded executioner standing at the end of the pier. As had been the routine for the past 20 minutes, two guards shoved a prisoner to his knees next to the executioner. The masked man pointed the muzzle of his weapon behind the condemned man's right ear, and then, without a pause or a comment or a moment's hesitation, he pulled the trigger. Sanguine spray erupted from the captive's head, and the body snapped forward, the mangled face leading the way down to the water. It crashed into the surface of the lake, just like so many before it, and just like so many more, waiting on the shore for their turn to die. And a videographer on the shoreline recorded it all for posterity. The shrinking row of prisoners remained passive, kneeling on the lakeside, over 12 armed men at the ready standing on all sides of them. Some flinched with the rifle's report, others flinched with the sound of the splash, knowing their ruined, dead bodies would follow suit in moments. And soon, two armed ISIS fighters walked down the 15-meter-long wooden pier, stepped onto the rocky shoreline, and took the closest man in orange by his shoulders. Two more captors had just cut him from the rope tied around his waist, so the walking crew hefted the condemned from his knees to his feet and guided him back down the pier, shoving him onward if he slowed for an instant. The doomed man prayed softly in Arabic as he walked with his hands secured in front of him, his eyes on the wooden planks at his feet, not on the water, not on the dozens of bodies floating just off the end of the pier, not on his dead friends and comrades. The walk was 30 seconds in duration, and then the prisoner's sandaled feet stopped in the pool of blood at the end of the wooden planks. Here, the lead executioner waited, his Kalashnikov hanging low from the sling around his neck. The executioner said nothing. The prisoner in orange knelt. He showed no emotion, but only continued to pray, his eyes closed now. The two men who had delivered him here took a step back. Their own boots and pants and even the ammunition racks on their chests were covered in blood splatter, and they kept their weapons raised, barrels just behind their prisoner's ears. But they did not fire. They looked on while the executioner raised his Kalashnikov, glanced towards the cameraman back at the edge of the pier to make certain he was getting all this, and then shot the young man in his right temple. Half of the man's head exploded, spewing outwards 3 meters above the water. The body spun and tipped forward and dropped into the blood-red lake face first, with a splash that was identical to the 25 other splashes that preceded it. The escort team had already turned away to take the next man in the rapidly shrinking row of prisoners. 42 now. There were Iraqis and Syrians and Turks in the row left to be killed this morning on the banks of Al Azam Lake, and soon the escorts had their hands on the shoulders of a 28-year-old, with matted hair curled in an afro, blood smeared on his face, and a black eye, and they pulled him up and along, beginning his short stroll to his death. That left 41 in the row of tied and kneeling men in orange jumpsuits, and the next man to wait his turn looked much the same as the others, filthy, tangled, dark hair in his eyes, flecked with bits of rubble and glass, his head down in supplication, his gaze averted from the impossibly horrific scene going on before him. Blood was caked on his bearded face from the beating he had taken in the makeshift prison the night before, and his nose was swollen. A punch to his jaw had left it scraped and bruised, and he was unable to open it fully. He also had a savage cut above his right ear and a bloody gash over his left eye. Still, he was not much worse off from the rest of the prisoners still alive. The main difference between him and the others was a small distinction that would serve as no comfort to them. He'd die first, and they'd die after. The prisoner to the left of the man with the beaten face raised his head now, defying the orders of the captors, and he looked at the horror around him. His name was Abdul Baset Rahal, and he was Syrian, a rebel soldier in the Free Syrian Army. He had been captured late the afternoon before, along with the prisoner with the beaten face, who was next in line to die. Rahal was a brave 24-year-old, but he was scared now. He was human, after all. Still, he took solace in the fact that he would be martyred by his death, like all of the others save for the man on his right. Rahal felt sadness for the beaten man at his shoulder, because he had done so much to help. He had been a lion in battle, a true hero in their righteous cause. And now he would die without achieving martyrdom, because he was no Muslim. Abdul Baset Rahal had only met the man the day before yesterday, but already the Syrian thought of the American as a fellow warrior, a kindred spirit, and yes, even as a friend. The Syrian found some peace in the fact that he would share his last few breaths with this great soldier, and peace in the fact that the ISIS captors had not learned that this man was a Westerner, because they certainly would have made a bigger show of his death for the camera, and whatever manner they would have chosen, it would have been so much more horrible than a simple rifle shot to the temple. The American was lucky. He'd get a bullet to the brain, and then it would be over. Rahal looked back down at the salty shore between his knees as the two escorts returned. The American was cut away from the others. There was a scuffle of boots on the rocks, and then the American was grabbed by both shoulders, yanked to a standing position, and pushed away, hauled off along the waterline and towards the pier. Rahal called out to him, careful to speak in Arabic, because although he spoke English fluently, doing so would tip off the ISIS monsters of the American's true origins.
Habibi!
Friend.
I swear it has been my great honor to fight and die alongside you.
For his words, Rahal received a rifle butt to the back of his head, knocking him onto his face and pulling other prisoners down with him by the rope tied around their waists. But the American either had not heard him, or did not understand, or perhaps his jaw was just swollen shut, because he made no reply. Cortland Gentry's bare feet slapped along the wooden pier, the coarse twine wrapped around his wrists in front of him bit into his skin. The AK barrels held by the men at his sides jabbed against his low back, and he felt the eyes of the other 14 ISIS gunmen behind him. He'd counted them when they got out of the trucks, and he counted them again as he was brought to the water's edge with the others. He passed the unarmed cameraman and kept going, glanced up now, and focused his eyes on the blood-drenched far edge of the pier. The masked man with the wired stock AK and the daggers in his belt beckoned him with a bored wave of his rifle. He was a thick man, but even so, Gentry could see that the executioner had his chest puffed out, no doubt for the video and the attention paid to him by all on the hillside, Confederate and enemy alike. The American prisoner continued forward. His fate lay at the end of this pier. The walk was short, as if fate were anxious to get on with its day. One step past the executioner, Gentry was forced to his knees. He slipped in the gore coating the wooden planks, but recovered. He knelt with his head bowed and gazed down 3 feet to the surface of the lake, the water swirling blood red in the brown. The body of the most recent victim had drifted a few yards away, and this meant the American wouldn't crash into him as he himself went into the lake. Not that this gave him any great consolation at all. The escorts behind him took a half-step back, their gun barrels close to his head, and then Court heard the sling swivels of the executioner's rifle as the man lifted the weapon and trained it behind his right ear. This was it. Cortland Gentry lifted his head, squared his chin, and fixed his eyes in resolution. "Here we go," he whispered. Abdul-Baset Rahal, the young Syrian who would be the next to die, did not watch the execution of the American warrior. He just closed his eyes and listened for the boom of the rifle. When it came, it seemed louder than all the others now that he was focused fully on the sound, and the report had only just trailed away when the splash came. Al-Azam Lake had accepted its newest victim, and the Syrian knew it was now his time to walk to the edge of the bloody pier. Chapter 1. 1 week earlier. Cimetière du Père Lachaise is the most visited cemetery in the world, but the Paris landmark was all but deserted on this rainy, gray, and cool weekday morning. An elderly couple fed squirrels on the cobblestones. A dozen young people stood solemnly in front of Jim Morrison's fenced-off but simple plot. A group of German hipsters lounged among the graves surrounding Oscar Wilde's tomb. And a lone man took photos of the statue of Euterpe, the muse of music, as she wept above composer Frédéric Chopin's mausoleum. There might have been 75 visitors in all on the property, but the cemetery spread over 100 hilly and wooded acres, so anyone who wanted privacy could find it easily here, in the warren of tombs, crypts, cobblestoned lanes, and old oak. And one man had done just that. A dark-complected 55-year-old with thinning gray hair sat alone a few rows up the hill from Molière's tomb. On a small bench that one had to either know about or stumble upon to locate, his name was Dr. Tarek Halabi, and there wasn't much about the man to make him stand out from the average Parisian of Middle Eastern descent, although someone with knowledge of fashion might pick up on the fact that his raincoat was a Khitan that ran north of 2,000 euros, and they might therefore come to the quite reasonable assumption that this was a man of significant means. As he sat there in the stillness of the cemetery, Halabi pulled out his wallet and looked at a small photo he kept there. A young man and a young woman standing together, smiling into the lens, with hope and intelligence in their eyes, that said the future was theirs to command. For 20 seconds, Halabi stared at the photo, till drops of rain began to fall, splashing on the image and blurring the smiling faces. He dried the photo off with his thumb, put his wallet back in his coat, and looked up to the sky. He lifted his umbrella and got ready to pop it open, but then the phone he'd placed on the bench next to him buzzed and lit up. He forgot about the impending shower, put down the umbrella, and read the text. Crematorium, alone. Lose the goons. The man in the raincoat sat up straighter and looked around nervously. He saw no one, only tombs and gravestones and trees and birds. Cold sweat formed on the back of his collar. He stood, but before he began walking he sent a reply. "I am alone." A new text appeared, and the man in the raincoat felt his heart pummel the inside of his chest. Two men with guns in their coats at the entrance, two more 50 meters east of you. They go, or I go. Dr. Halabi stared at the phone a moment before typing out his reply with fingers that trembled. "Of course." He placed a call, held the phone to his ear, and spoke in French. "He sees you, and he won't do this with you here. Take the others, go get a coffee, and wait for my call." A pause. "It's fine." The man ended the call, slipped the phone into his raincoat, and began walking up the hill towards the crematorium. 5 minutes later, Dr. Halabi held his umbrella over his head while he walked through the steady rain. The huge crematorium of Père Lachaise was higher on the hill, another 60 meters on, but Halabi was still making his way through the narrow passages between the tall mausoleums all around. As he advanced, his eyes fixed on another man, himself holding an umbrella. He appeared around the side of the huge crematorium, then stepped into a parking lot between Halabi and the building. Halabi expected the man to continue in his direction, so he was surprised when he instead climbed into a small work truck and drove off to the west. Halabi was doubly surprised to hear a voice behind him now, not 3 meters away, coming from a recess between a pair of crypts. "Stop there. Don't turn around." The man spoke English, softly, his voice barely louder than the sound of rain hitting Halabi's umbrella. "As you say," the doctor replied, standing still now, doing his best to keep his hands from shaking. He was partially shielded on three sides by the marble walls of crypts, and in front of him row after row of waist-high tombstones jutted from the wet grass. The voice behind him said, "You brought it?" Halabi was Syrian. He lived in France, but his English was good. "As instructed, it is in my front pants pocket. Shall I reach for it?" "Well, I'm not putting my hand down your pants." "Yes." Tarek Halabi reached into his pocket slowly and retrieved a blue badge in a plastic case hanging from a lanyard. There was also a folded sheet of paper with an address on it. He held both items back over his shoulder. "The badge will get you into the event. VIP access. As you know, there is no photo. You will have to provide that yourself." The man behind him took the badge and the paper. "Anything new to report?" Halabi detected the American accent now, and he knew this was, for certain, the man who had come so highly recommended. He didn't know much about the American other than his reputation. He had been told that this asset was a legend in the world of espionage and covert ops, so, of course, he would be thorough in his preparations, exacting in his demands. Halabi replied, "All is the same as in the information you were given yesterday." "Security around the target?" "As you were told, 5 men."
"And the threat?"
"Also the same as before. No more than 4 hostiles, 5 at most.
5 is more than 4.
Now Halabi swallowed.
"Yes, well, I was told probably just 4 hostiles, so the intelligence is not certain. But it is no worry because the hostiles will not act until tomorrow, and you will proceed tonight. Won't you?"
The asset did not answer the question.
"And the target, still departing France tomorrow?"
"This is unchanged. The flight leaves at 1 p.m. Again, tonight is the last night where we can—
"The address written on this paper, is this the RP?"
The what?"
"The rally point."
"I'm sorry, I do not know what this means." Halabi thought he heard a soft sigh of frustration from the other man. Then,
"Is this where I go when it's done?"
"Oh, yes. It is the address of our safe house here in Paris." There was a longer pause now. A grackle landed on a tombstone just a few meters in front of the man with the umbrella, and the rain picked up even more. Finally, the American asset spoke again, but his voice sounded less sure than before.
"The man I talked to on the phone, he was French. You are not French."
"The one who you spoke with, the one who hired you through the service in Monte Carlo, he works for me." Halabi heard soft, wet footsteps, and then the American came into view around the umbrella. He was in his 30s, a touch shorter than Halabi's 6 feet, with a dark beard and a simple black raincoat. The hood hung low over his eyes, rainwater dripped off it in front of his face. The American said,
"You are Dr. Tarek Halabi, aren't you?"
Halabi's heart began pumping wildly upon hearing this dangerous man uttering his name.
"Oui, that is correct."
He switched his umbrella to his left hand and extended his right. The asset did not move to accept the handshake.
"You are the director of the Free Syria Exile Union?"
"Co-director, actually. My wife shares the title."
"You supply medical equipment, medicine, food, water, and blankets to civilians and resistance fighters in Syria?"
"Well, originally, yes.
Relief used to be our only mandate, but we are now involved with more direct opposition of the regime of Ahmed Al-Azam.
Halabi spoke through a nervous smile now.
As you know, we haven't hired you to deliver blankets.
The American continued eyeing him, adding to Halabi's disquiet. One more question.
Yes, of course.
How the hell are you still alive? The rain beat down ceaselessly on the umbrella and the marble structures around the two men. Halabi said,
I don't understand. A hell of a lot of people would love to see you dead. The Syrian government, the Islamic State, the Russians, Hezbollah, the Iranians. And yet, you came this morning in person to meet with a man you did not know. And you are here alone.
Halabi answered defensively.
You asked me to send my people away.
If I asked you to shoot yourself in the face, would you do it? Halabi tried to control his breathing. With all the conviction he could muster, he said,
I am not afraid.
The truth was he was stone-cold terrified, but he did his best to hide it.
I was told you are the best there is. Why on earth should I be afraid?
Because I bet you were told I'm the best there is at killing. Halabi blanched but recovered quickly.
Well, we are on the same side, are we not?
I am taking money to do a job. That's not exactly a side, is it? The older man forced a smile.
Then I guess I should hope the other side didn't offer you more to eliminate me.
When the American did not return the smile, he added,
It was important I met you. I wanted you to know how crucial tonight is for our movement.
The American seemed to be thinking things over, as if he might just drop the badge in the mud, turn away, and forget this entire affair. Instead, he just said,
Trust will get you killed.
Even though he was scared, Halabi realized he was under scrutiny now, and he knew he had to assert himself to earn the respect of this man. He brought his shoulders back and his chin up.
Well, monsieur, if you are here to kill me, get on with it, and if not, let's end this meeting, because you and I both have a lot to do today.
The man in the hooded raincoat sniffed. He was not to be rushed. His eyes shifted around the cemetery for a moment, and then they locked back on the doctor.
I support what you are doing. I took this job because I wanted to help.
Halabi let out a soft breath of relief.
And that's why it pisses me off to learn that you're an amateur. You're going to get your ass killed long before you or the Free Syria Exile Union actually accomplishes anything. Dudes like you don't last long as revolutionaries unless you take extreme measures to protect yourself and your operation.
Halabi had never been referred to as dude in his life, but he did not interact often with Americans outside the occasional surgical symposium. He said,
I am quite aware of the danger. Hiring you, I was told, was the right decision. I hope you will prove me right. By our actions, we can, perhaps, deal a serious blow to the Syrian regime and hasten the end of this cruel war. Nothing you could do for our cause could be more important than tonight, here in Paris.
Halabi raised an eyebrow.
Unless I could persuade you to go to Syria yourself to eliminate President Azam.
The remark was clearly a joke, but the asset did not laugh.
I said I support what you're doing. I didn't say I was suicidal. Trust me, you'll never get my ass into that hellhole.
That hellhole is my home.
Well, it's not mine.
Both men listened to the rain for a moment, and then Halabi said,
Please, monsieur, help us succeed tonight, here.
After another bout of silence, the American in the hooded coat said,
Pull all surveillance on the target. I'll take over. And watch your back. If no one is actively targeting you yet, that will probably change after tonight.
He turned away and began moving off around the tombstones to the west. Halabi called after him, causing him to stop after only a few steps.
You asked me how it is I am still alive.
The American did not turn back. He just stood there, facing away.
My wife has a philosophy about this. She thinks all the best and bravest of my people died in the first years of the conflict. An entire generation of heroes. Now, those of us who are left after 7 years of fighting, we are the ones who were too afraid to get involved in the beginning. My wife says The resistance leaders of today aren't in power now because we are the strongest, the boldest, the most capable. We are in power now, alive now, simply because we are all that remain.
The asset began walking again, drifting off through the tombstones, but he spoke over the sound of the rain.
No offense, Doc, but I think your wife might be onto something.
Tarek Halaby realized he'd never really studied the man's face, and now, 30 seconds after looking right at him, he doubted he'd recognize him if they met again. Soon, the American disappeared from view through the rain and the dead. Chapter 2. The small and Spartan 15th arrondissement apartment saw no natural light when the sun was out, but on a rainy afternoon like this, the third floor walk-up appeared positively subterranean inside, except for a single lamp on a desk in the corner. A man sat alone under the lamplight, hunched over the desk, listening to the rain on the nearby shuttered window while he worked. He looked up from his project when he heard a noise over the water dripping off the roof. It was the sound of footsteps in the private courtyard outside, and then the echo of a door slamming shut. The man rose silently and moved to the window, opened the shutters a few inches, and looked down, his right hand hovering over the grip of the Glock pistol in his waistband. He saw the origin of the noise instantly. An old woman from apartment 2C stood in the rain, lifted the lid to a garbage can, and poured a full pan of used cat litter into the can. She closed the lid again and returned to the door to the stairwell, and it slammed behind her several seconds after she headed back inside. Cortland Gentry scanned the entire scene below him now, slowly and carefully, then took a calming breath. He closed the shutters, returned to his chair, then leaned back over his project. There were a few items lying on the table next to his backpack. Coiled climbing ropes, a gun cleaning kit. The blue badge given to him by the man in the cemetery lay on the desk before him, under the bright light. Next to it was a passport-quality photo of himself, a 2-inch square shot of him wearing the same clothes he wore now. A charcoal suit coat, a white shirt with a spread collar, and a black tie. Taking his time to check the image carefully, he determined it wasn't perfect, but it was good enough to pass normal scrutiny. The apartment was all but bare. No personal items lay about, only items needed for today's operation. On his left, just 5 feet from where he sat, a blue tablecloth was attached low on the wall with pushpins, and a few feet in front of it, a camera sat on the seat of a wooden chair. A fluorescent desk lamp stood on the wooden floor pointed towards the tablecloth. 5 minutes earlier, Court had turned on the light, pressed the 10-second delay on the camera, sat on the floor in front of the blue background, and stared into the lens until the camera clicked. After that, he flipped the light back off and printed the image out on the color printer in the corner that he'd purchased for this single 2-inch square image. Now he took a pair of tweezers and used a craft store glue stick to affix his picture in place on the ID, then pressed down on it with the bottom of a plastic cup from the kitchen, taking his time to make sure it was secure so the corners would not peel. While he waited, he did a few neck rolls to relax. He wasn't a fan of the arts and crafts work that came with his job. He was slow and meticulous with it, and this sort of thing stressed him out. Only by necessity, and only over a long period of time had he gotten good at it. Court had served for over a decade in the Central Intelligence Agency, then 5 more years in the private sector as an assassin for hire. When CIA was running him, he could order up docs, credos, credit cards, and fully backstop legends with little trouble. But working as a solo act, he'd have to either find private paper hangers or create what he needed himself. Sometimes he was forced to rely solely on his clients to provide the documents for his needs, but today was something of a hybrid situation. His client had been able to procure an authentic badge that would get him into the event he needed to infiltrate, but Court didn't trust his client enough to pass over a photo of himself for them to complete the project. He'd do the work himself to maintain his personal security. Court had become something of a hybrid himself. He was back with the CIA in an ad hoc contract role, but he retained the autonomy to accept freelance work when he so desired, and today was 100% freelance. Langley had no idea where Court was or what he was doing, and that was by design. Court didn't know if they'd approve of today's mission, and he didn't give a damn. For a long time, he'd wanted to do something to support the fight against the Syrian regime, and this was his way of doing it without going into Syria. A mission into Syria, Court had determined via study of the situation and his many years of personal experience as an intelligence and operational asset, would be a fool's errand. He'd taken this job from a handler based in Monte Carlo who, for a 20% finder's fee, served as a cutout in the initial negotiations between the contractor and the client. Court decided the work asked of him looked like it would be difficult, but doable. As an additional bonus, the job was in Paris, and Paris was probably Court's favorite city in the world. But now he couldn't help but worry about the amateurish behavior of his clients. Yes, they seemed to have some top-flight intelligence about his target tonight, but their operational tradecraft was all wrong. Still, the job itself felt right, and that was why Court was here. He'd recently completed a mission in Southeast Asia with flying colors, but the operation had left him angry, empty. The United States had come out the ultimate victors thanks to Court's actions, and that was the plan, but it was an ugly op, and Court's own actions on the mission left him feeling angry and conflicted. Now he wanted to feel positive about what he was doing, like back in the days before his reconciliation with the agency. Court believed in this Paris job, so despite his misgivings about the danger, he would continue on. He'd earned the moniker Gray Man for his ability to remain low profile in the shadows while still completing his arduous assignments. He had the skill to succeed, he believed in his plan, and he believed in his skill to make it through tonight to see the sunrise tomorrow. He told himself all he had to do was keep his eyes open, to avoid getting burned by his employer's bad practices. This was his first work in 2 months. He'd been lying low, first in Slovenia, then in Austria. He'd spent his time training and hiding, reading and thinking. He was in as good physical shape as he'd been in years, and he'd focused intensely on the physical side of his development recently, because he had concerns he had lost a step mentally. No, it wasn't PTSD or concussions or early onset dementia that threatened to slow him. It was something much more debilitating. It was a woman. He'd met her on his last operation, spent just a few days with her, but still he could not get her out of his mind. She was a Russian intelligence officer, now in the hands of the CIA, and buttoned up in some safe house back in the States. And this meant there might be even less chance of him seeing her again than if she'd been working at the Lubyanka in Moscow. If ever a relationship were doomed to failure, Court acknowledged, it was this one. But he had feelings for her, to the extent he wondered if he was the same person he was before he met her. Had he lost that step? Would he hesitate in danger? Was he open to compromise, now that there was someone out there who actually meant something to him? As he worked on his forged ID badge, Court considered all of this for the 1,000th time in the past 2 months, and for the 1,001st time, he admonished himself. Jesus, Gentry, turn that shit off. Thoughts like these will get you killed. This was no life for a man in love. Court saw himself as an instrument, a tool, mission-focused in the extreme. The woman on his mind was on the other side of the globe, embroiled in her own issues, no doubt. And he knew he'd do well to forget about her, so he could operate at 100%. He knew he needed to remain mentally sharp, especially today, because shit was going to get crazy before the night was through. The man in the darkened apartment shook off concerns of his diminished mental alertness and climbed into a black two-piece motorcycle rain suit, pulling the rubbery material over the Armani. Then he hefted a pair of black backpacks, locked the door to his apartment on the way out, and made his way down the dark and narrow staircase towards the street. Paris shone in the afternoon sun, the buildings and streets still glistening from the rain shower that blew out of the area a half hour earlier. Cars rolled by the majestic 17th and 18th century architecture of the 8th arrondissement, just north of the Seine and within a few blocks east of the imposing Arc de Triomphe. The Hotel Potocki on Avenue de Friedland was a structure that would have stood out as a magnificent showpiece in most any other city on earth, but here in Paris, the Potocki was just another beautiful building on just another beautiful block full of beautiful buildings. It had been built as a palace 200 years earlier for a family of Polish nobility who had made it their life's work to erect ornate residences all over Europe, and they'd spared no expense to illustrate their wealth and power to the Parisians. Even today, it remained one of the most elegant mansions in the city, rented out as a high-dollar venue for parties, events, and private get-togethers of the elite. This afternoon, the entrances to the building were surrounded by crowds, all holding their camera phones high in hopes of catching images of the attendees of the exclusive function inside. In addition to the hundreds of onlookers, photographers and reporters milled about, limo drivers stood by their freshly polished vehicles in nearby lots, and private security manned the streets and sidewalks. But the real action was inside. Through the monumental bronze doors cast by Christofle, up the grand marble staircase, and in the opulent salle des lustres, some 300 well-dressed men and women sat around a long, glowing runway that ran below and between rows of crystal chandeliers. The room was packed shoulder to shoulder, and thumping music and flashing lights gave an energetic, almost manic, feel to the scene. The announcer proclaimed the arrival of the winter collection. The crowd leaned in, and one at a time, lithe models began marching authoritatively out onto the catwalk, wearing dramatic velvet capes, thigh-high boots, and embroidered chiffon dresses. The hum of the crowd was unmistakably approving. In the ninth row, to the right of the runway, sitting at the southern end of the room and holding a camera and an iPad, a man in a charcoal Armani suit sat next to an elderly woman with a small poodle nestled in her arms. The man's eyeglasses were as refined as his silk tie and handkerchief, and he looked on at the procession traversing the catwalk just like everyone else, craning his head, nodding along with each new look, and tapping notes into his tablet. The man had avoided the majority of the cameras, and even the lights from the runway did not reach to him in his seat. He was just a face in the crowd. No one in the room was focusing on him, and other than the guard who scanned his pass and the roving waitress with the silver tray of champagne flutes, he'd had no interaction with anyone in the building, though he'd entered a full 90 minutes earlier. As a new model stepped out from the wings and proceeded down the catwalk, the man in the Armani suit focused intently for a moment, then looked away. "Not her," he told himself. He took a moment to look around the room again, and not for the first time in the last hour and a half. Court Gentry told himself that this was probably pretty much what his version of hell would look like. Through the two bright lights, he saw the vapid eyes, and through the too loud music, he heard the insipid discussions on inane topics all around him in multiple languages, conversations that he felt made him dumber by the minute for having been forced to listen to them. The focus on the clothes and the colors and the style and the scene was nearly a foreign tongue to him, but he understood enough to know he didn't give a damn about anything being discussed, anywhere in the building. He couldn't imagine anything more annoying than the crowd he sat in, the words from their mouths, the oohs and ahs about a bunch of clothes no one off a runway would ever wear anywhere, and no one who'd ever eaten a sandwich in their life could fit into in the first place. Everyone else here insisted on referring to this as Paris Fashion Week, but still, Court was pretty sure he was in hell. This was the Zuhair Mourad show of the Haute Couture collection, and Court had done just enough study on the designer and his work to pass relaxed scrutiny as a member of the alternative fashion press. His cover was as a freelancer, sent to get impressions and images of the periphery of Fashion Week for an online style magazine, to chronicle the guests and the clothes and the scene, whatever the hell that was. Court looked around. A coked-up 60-year-old man with a horror show facelift and eyeliner danced in his chair on the other side of the runway, sloshing half his champagne on the leg of a 19-year-old boy seated next to him. To the extent Court had a scene at all, this sure as shit wasn't it. But it was Court's job to fit in, no matter what the surroundings, and he did his job well. He was invisible here, because it was his job to be so. Just as it had been his job to remain invisible while riding the metro in D.C., roaming the streets of Hong Kong, or piloting a yacht off Menorca. His eyes flicked back to the runway, and as the beautiful women came out one by one, he continued scanning them. "Not her," Not her. Not her either. His attention moved from the slow procession of models and off the runway entirely. Two athletic men with dark suits and dark hair entered the hall on his right from an access door near the entrance to the stage. They stood back against the wall, scanning the crowd. Court pinged on them instantly, and his eyes casually followed them as they moved closer to the curtain where the models emerged. Across the lights of the runway, he saw another pair of goons, similarly attired, both dark and swarthy. They stood close to the action, and directly behind them, a few seated men and women called out to them to try to get them to move. A security man attached to the venue stepped over to the pair on the far side and ushered them a few feet closer to the wall. They complied, more or less, but they remained within reach of the models on the stage and runway. And then, a tall female model with coal black hair marched out from behind the wings in a black chiffon dress with silver piping. She was as beautiful as all the others, perhaps even more intense and serious about her work than the rest, as she moved up the runway. Through the flashing of dozens of cameras, she marched her stilettos to the beat of an old David Bowie song souped up with industrial techno. Court noticed all four of the big men looking up at her, and then he noticed all four men turning and scanning the crowd. They didn't follow her walk down the length of the raised platform, but their eyes stayed on the 300 or so in the audience. Court turned his attention away from the bodyguards, and he focused again on the model. She was utterly stunning. And she was his target. Chapter 3 Court had her bio down cold. Her name was Bianca Medina. She was 26, positively ancient for a model, although she was one of the most gorgeous women Court had ever laid eyes on, striking even on a runway full of stunning women. There was a confidence in her moves that he, a complete layman in the world of fashion modeling, recognized instantly. He raised his camera, pointed it at her, and took a few shots like the rest of the crowd holding cameras, but quickly he turned the lens to the first duo of security men at the back wall. He took several pictures, then shifted in his seat a little and got a few shots of the pair on his right, on his side of the runway. Private security protection was not the norm for the models here at the Zuhair Murad show, but Court knew things about Bianca Medina no one else in the room did. And for that reason, he knew she didn't have much in common with the other women walking the runway today. She showcased her dress and left through the sequined curtain at the rear of the stage. The security men disappeared through the stage doors at the same moment she did, no doubt forming around her backstage to escort her to her dressing area. Court assumed she'd be hustled into another outfit and sent back out onto the runway in minutes, but he'd seen all he needed to see, so he stood and left the Salle de Lustre. As he headed down the grand staircase on his way to a side entrance of the Hotel Potocki, he thought about what he'd just learned. He'd been told Medina would have her own security team of 5 men, but he'd needed to test the accuracy of this information he'd been given on this assignment. With his own eyes, he'd seen 4 bodyguards, and he assumed another man would be waiting outside in a vehicle, so his intel appeared to be accurate. Good, he thought. His client's tradecraft might have been amateurish, but it seemed so far at least that his intelligence product was solid. Court exited the building, passed by dozens of mostly young men and women clambering to get a look at a famous guest or a beautiful model at the side exit. Then, he walked 2 blocks to his black 2010 Yamaha XJ6 motorcycle, left in a lot on the Rue Chateaubriand. Here, he unlocked the top case on the back of his bike, and then took off his Armani jacket. After kicking out of his leather wingtips, he pulled the 2-piece motorcycle rain suit from the case and put it on in seconds, then slipped into a pair of black tennis shoes. He crammed his coat and shoes in the case and relocked it, donned his black helmet, lowered the smoked visor, and climbed aboard the bike. He drove around to the back of the venue, having already scoped out the exit the models were using for the fashion show. Here, he parked 50 yards from the door but remained on his motorcycle. And he steeled himself for a long wait. Court sat on his bike, his attention shifting from the Hotel Potocki to the passing vehicles on the roads to the windows and roofs of buildings in the neighborhood. Every now and then a car would roll up to the rear door and someone would either climb out of the vehicle and step into the building, or step out of the building and climb into the vehicle. The 3 dozen or so onlookers on the sidewalk crowded behind the rope and kept back by the security man took pictures of the action. But despite the movement, Court saw no hint of his target. 1 hour and 40 minutes after Court took up his watch, a silver Cadillac Escalade pulled up by the rear door of the Potoki, and the employee access door opened in symmetry with the big vehicle's arrival. Court locked his eyes to the scene now, thinking this looked like it could be a trained security movement in action. Just as he suspected, a pair of Bianca Medina's bodyguards stepped out of the building and looked around at the small crowd and the street, and then the model herself appeared. Her hands held her camel raincoat tight against her neck, her massive bag swung from her shoulder, and she walked with a determined gait. She kept her head down. Many in the crowd took pictures of her because she looked famous, even if they didn't know who in fact she was. In 5 seconds she was ensconced in the SUV, and it was moving as soon as the last door closed. Court fired up his bike and followed the Escalade to the east. The Yamaha wound through the thick early evening traffic on the Avenue de Friedland, following 150 yards back from the Escalade. He found himself too far behind at one point, so he ignored the lane markers and darted through the gridlock at an intersection, swaying left and right as needed to keep his momentum while the cars and trucks around the motorcycle moved at a snail's pace. Court kept his head on a swivel, his eyes firing down to his mirrors, making sure there wasn't a chase car working with Medina's protection element, or even another group targeting and following the model and her entourage. He'd satisfied himself he hadn't been compromised, but his tradecraft skills caused him to re-satisfy himself of his own personal security every few seconds. They were heading east, and this indicated to Court that they weren't going to one of 3 hotels with rooms reserved for models in the Zuhair Murad show. He'd doubted from the beginning his target would have much contact with the other women and girls, and this just confirmed his suspicion. He wasn't surprised she was steering clear of the more public places. He just leaned lower on his bike and told himself he couldn't lose her now, because he probably wouldn't be able to reacquire the woman if the Escalade disappeared in the traffic. Fortunately for the man on the motorcycle, the drive to his target's next destination was only 10 minutes. The Cadillac pulled up in front of an open set of red arched doors at 7 Rue Tronchet. Court had just made the turn in front of L'Église de Madeleine, a massive Roman Catholic church here in the 8th arrondissement, when he saw Bianca's long black hair emerge from the silver SUV. She marched through the open doorway surrounded by 4 of her 5 bodyguards. He continued heading north past the scene, and only looked into the arch to see a darkened forecourt, and confirmed that there was no signage or other indicators of what sort of building Medina was entering. Court rolled his bike up onto the curb a block to the north and parked it next to a public toilet. From here he could still see the front of the building at 7 Rue Tronchet across the street, but he was out of range of any possible cameras around the building. He pulled out his phone without removing his helmet. He pushed some buttons and waited for the call to be answered. Soon, a male voice with a French accent spoke into Court's Bluetooth earpiece.
Oui? C'est Rue Tronchet. Et vous sûr?
Are you sure?
Bien sûr.
Of course. There was a slight delay as his contact did some research on his end about the location, so Court took the time to check his own security here. It seemed to be a typical cloudy spring afternoon on a typical central Paris intersection, which meant a lot of traffic, both pedestrian and automobile, and quite a few people just standing around. There were window shoppers, smokers, standing in front of shops and office buildings, men and women selling out of food kiosks and newsstands. But within 10 seconds of the beginning of his scan, a pair of men on the opposite sidewalk set off Court's internal alarm. They were on motorcycles next to each other, one man on a black Honda and the other on a red Suzuki. And they scanned the area, much like Court himself was now doing. Court looked around at the buildings behind the pair, tried to come up with a legitimate reason they would pick that part of the sidewalk to park, and came up with nothing. A woman's clothing store, a perfumery, a shop that made and sold high-end confectionery. Sure, these guys could be out picking up gifts for wives or girlfriends, but they had no bags with them, only backpacks with webbing on the outside, used to strap more gear on, a feature common with military and police personnel. He put them in their late 30s or early 40s. They were relatively fit men, one bearded with wavy brown hair and the other completely bald and clean-shaven. There was a hard edge to both that was easily apparent to Court, even from this distance. They weren't military, not active duty anyway, and they certainly weren't beat cops, but Court wondered if they might be attached to the police or government in some capacity. Their backpacks and helmets looked well used, but both their motorcycles appeared to be almost new. He had the impression that these guys could handle more powerful bikes than the ones they were sitting on, so he pegged the motorcycles as rentals. As Court concentrated on remaining subtle, performing the balancing act of surveilling two people while at the same time remaining sensitive to any possible counter-surveillance, his earpiece came alive again with a response from the Frenchman.
Cette rue tranchée is a hôtel particulier, a private guest house for wealthy travelers visiting Paris. 4 suites, 5 floors, minimal security, with cameras in the lobby, stairs, and lift. Good locks, no easy roof access.
My problem, not yours.
D'accord.
Agreed.
What do you need?
A car. Somewhere within 3 blocks of the target location.
It will be delivered. You will be texted with the drop-off location.
Okay. And then, question. Do you have any eyes trailing the target?
No. You demanded we discontinue surveillance.
You are certain your guys are clear of this scene?
Absolutely so. We did not have any idea she would be going to Rue Tronchet. All our assets are accounted for. Why? Is there a problem?
Court looked up to the two bikers again. The brown-haired man on the Honda was gone. He must have headed off to the south, otherwise Court would have seen him race past. And the bald man on the Suzuki was just now putting his helmet on. In seconds, he fired up his bike and rolled off to the north.
Allô?
Court asked, who else might be interested in the target? Caucasians, Europeans. After a pause, the Frenchman said,
no one. Certainly no Caucasians that I can think of. None.
But Court was less sure now than he had been about the pair. Court was certain they hadn't ID'd him, so he couldn't imagine why they would leave like this if, indeed, they had been following Medina or holding surveillance on her building. And, try as he might, Court couldn't find anyone else in the crowd who looked like they might have replaced these two in coverage.
Allô?
The man said again. It's nothing, Court replied, though he wasn't at all sure. Just deliver the car and text me the location. Court made to hang up when he heard the man speak.
When do you think you will be able to?
Court ended the call. He started the Yamaha again, brushing off lingering thoughts of the two men. He drove off to circle the block and try to find a better place for surveillance, because he was certain this was his target's residence for the evening, and this would be the evening he'd come for her. Chapter 4. At 10 p.m., Bianca Medina left her private apartment on the Rue Tronchet, climbed into her silver Escalade with her full security detail, and rode in silence for the 10-minute journey to a 2-Michelin-star restaurant on the Rue Lord Byron. Here, she was escorted into an ornate private room by the maitre d'. The door was closed, and she dined alone. Well, not really alone. 3 of her 5 minders sat at the 2 other tables in the room, with a 4th man just beyond the door to the main dining room, and the 5th with the Escalade outside. The men around her did not make eye contact with Bianca, nor she with them. There was little talking between the protectee and any of her protectors, and no real conversation whatsoever. The detail and the principal had a prickly relationship that no one in the mix seemed anxious to rectify. Bianca sat at her candlelit table, nursed a flute of champagne, and picked at a salad with no dressing. She alternatively nibbled on her food and thumbed a copy of French Vogue she'd pulled out of her handbag. Bianca was from Spain, but she spoke French and English fluently, having lived in Paris and New York working as a model, dividing her time between the 2 fashion meccas for nearly a decade before all but retiring 3 years earlier. Her waiter was a handsome man in his mid-20s, a few years younger than her and 1,000 times more upbeat and talkative, and he was clearly fascinated by the sullen-looking beauty with the expensive jewelry and the big security entourage. He attempted to flirt with her at every opportunity, showing himself not to be intimidated by either her magnificence or the gruff men surrounding her. Bianca had ignored his early attempts at small talk, but this Casanova wasn't one to take no for an answer. So the more curt she became, the more he wanted to break through her tough exterior. As he removed her salad plate and replaced her silverware, he asked, "Are you in town on vacation?"
"Work,"
she said, not even looking up from Vogue.
"Of course, you must be here for Fashion Week."
She did not reply.
"A supermodel. I would surely recognize you if I spent more time following celebrity magazines."
Nothing. After a pause, the waiter leaned a little closer.
"Madame, I just have to say it."
She flipped a page in her magazine.
"No, monsieur. Whatever it is, you do not."
The handsome waiter hesitated again, surprised at the remark, but he recovered. He somehow didn't get the hint that Bianca was not a woman to be toyed with.
"Forgive me, but while I understand why a true beauty like you must be well protected, I don't understand why you can't give just a little smile. It is always sad to dine alone, c'est vrai, but a perfect woman in a perfect restaurant in a perfect city should at least try to find a way to be happy."
Bianca lifted her eyes from the magazine only now, but not to look at the Frenchman. Instead, she just glanced towards Shalish, the leader of her security detail, sitting alone at a candlelit table by the door to the dining room. He had certainly heard the exchange, she knew, because Shalish missed nothing. Shalish, in turn, looked to his two men, and Bianca turned her attention to the waiter now. In French, she said,
"Go away, come back with food, or don't come back at all."
The waiter was used to women playing hard to get, but he clearly was not used to such cruel rejection. After a moment's pause, he bowed curtly and turned on his heels, heading towards the door. Shalish glared at the waiter as the young man passed by. As Bianca began to look back down to her magazine, she saw two of her bodyguards standing, off the look from their boss, no doubt, and following the young man out the door. 10 seconds later, she heard an exclamation in the kitchen, then a clanking of plates and glasses. She could picture the scene. The waiter was either up against the wall or down on the floor, and he was in pain. She imagined the good-looking man would be sent home for the evening, perhaps to tend to a black eye or a sore shoulder joint. To the guards around her, to the restaurant staff, and most certainly to the waiter with the wounded body and pride, Bianca Medina appeared to be a cold and cruel bitch. But as far as she was concerned, she'd done the would-be Lothario a favor. If she'd shown any interest in him, given him any sort of green light that emboldened him to press on with his attempts at seduction, the men with Medina would have probably taken it upon themselves to put the waiter in the hospital with shattered bones and broken teeth. Bianca had learned over the past few years that the kindest turn she could do her fellow man was often to encourage them to just walk on by her without a passing glance. Minutes later, a new waiter, this one older, blander, and almost catatonic in his countenance, appeared with her entree, coq au vin, with the sauce in a silver boat on the side. He put it in front of her with a quick and perfunctory "Bon appétit," and then he was gone. Bianca Medina reached for her fork and knife now. She put the handsome young waiter out of her mind and did not think of him again. The Escalade pulled back in front of the archway at 7 Rue Tronchet at midnight, and Bianca Medina returned to her 3,000-square-foot fifth-floor suite. While one of the dark-suited men remained in the lobby, the four others entered the suite with her. They took up their positions in the living area, kitchen, and guest rooms, while she entered the master bedroom alone without a word to anyone. She'd fly home tomorrow, but not till early afternoon, and she knew her detail would not allow her to go anywhere other than to breakfast before heading to the airport. This meant she could sleep in. So she dawdled in her room for a while. She looked through the rest of her magazine while lying on the bed, then spent a few minutes standing on the balcony and looking out over the forecourt of the property. She regarded the single shot of brandy in the large lead crystal decanter on the nightstand by her bed, then poured the shot into the snifter left there for her. She drank the sweet liquid while she perused her magazine once more. And then, shortly after 1 a.m., she pulled an extra blanket from the linen closet next to the bathroom door,